The sun was just beginning to set. She fell asleep in her uniform when it was still light out. "Terrain, Terrain, pull up, pull up," the mechanical female voice on the far side of the flight deck door. The remnants of another dream. She knew the voice from the hundreds, perhaps thousands of landings when she was in the jump seat nearest the cockpit on certain planes. On some aircraft, the ones where the passengers were staring straight at you, they called it the Sharon Stone seat, the basic instinct bench. When she awoke, when she understood they were neither landing nor crashing, it was nighttime, and the peak of the Empire State Building was colored red. One time when her sister's family was visiting, she had looked up online what color the building would be that night, hoping she would be allowed to share the view with them and explain to her nephew and niece the reason behind that evening's selection. But Rosemary had made it clear that they would not be going to Murray Hill, and she did not want Cassie alone with the kids. She wasn't hungry, but she figured she should eat something and went to the kitchen. She recalled again how Alex had ordered the Blanquette de Veau at the restaurant in Dubai. She imagined herself telling the FBI agents that the deceased had no objection to eating veal and was a tender and rather exquisite lover in the shower. He reread, doorstop novels by long-dead Russian writers. In her head, she heard herself volunteering that, for one night, at least, he drank as much as she did, and that had been a lot, enough for her to black out. What would Frank Hammond have said to any of that? She gazed for a moment at the portion of his business card that peeked out from behind the magnet. The refrigerator wasn't empty, far from it, but there was still little in there that was edible. It was mostly unfinished Indian takeout that had gone bad, condiments, diet soda, and yogurt that had expired months ago. She found a can of tomato soup in the pantry and some crackers, a little soft with age, but edible, and made herself the sort of meal that she recalled her mother might have prepared for her when she was home from school with the flu. She ate in silence on the living room couch, watching the moon high above the Manhattan skyline. She ate in the dark, but for the light from the kitchen. She thought she might look for news stories about Sokolov on her phone when she was finished. She might even boot up the laptop she rarely used. But she feared she wouldn't sleep if she did, and it was going to be hard enough going back to bed after having slept 5 hours already that evening. A sentence came to her. "I awoke beside a dead man." Then another. "I may have gotten away with murder." But then she shook her head, because while it was conceivable that she had killed Alex, she continued to feel deep inside that she hadn't. Oh, there had been moments when she had lost faith and felt waves of debilitating self-hatred. Her body actually spasmed ever so slightly once in the elevator in her building. But usually she was able to convince herself that she hadn't killed him. She couldn't. She wouldn't. Not even in self-defense. For better or worse, that wasn't how she was wired. She also reminded herself that it remained highly unlikely that she had gotten away with anything. All she had done so far was make it back to America, where she would at least have a decent lawyer, assuming she could find one who would work for the pittance she really could pay. Her only definite crime, literal and metaphoric, was leaving the poor guy behind in the hotel room in Dubai. And if she hadn't killed him, then she was relieved now to have so many time zones between herself and whoever had. Either they had misjudged her and assumed she would call the hotel or the police and wind up a suspect in the homicide, perhaps she would even confess to it, or they had figured she would flee and didn't care. In this scenario, whoever had killed Alex had been a pro at this sort of thing, an executioner, and knew that she was just in the wrong bed on the wrong night, and spared her. They understood that she was uninvolved in whatever nastiness had led Alex to get himself practically beheaded. As she was putting her soup bowl into the dishwasher, She pondered how someone gets into a locked hotel room. Perhaps when she had the courage to Google Alex Sokolov, she would Google hotel room security. If whoever killed Alex worked at the Royal Phoenician, it was probably simple to unlock the door. She had a bottle of unopened red wine, a Chianti she rather liked and was saving for a special occasion, but remembered her vow that she wasn't going to drink. It wasn't quite 11 o'clock. She considered going to one of the late-night drugstores and getting a bottle of a pain reliever with the letters PM on it, or perhaps some flu remedy with a specifically drowsy formulation to knock a person out. Instead, she thought to herself, fuck it. Fuck it all. She wasn't going to be able to sleep. All that loomed, if she stayed here at home, was the prospect of tossing and turning and waiting for the lights on the Empire State Building to finally blink out. And then, at 2 or 2:30 in the morning, when she was desperate, uncorking that Chianti. She swiped across a few of the men who came up in her Tinder account, but none of the faces interested her. She thought of the different women she knew whom she could text and see where they were and what trouble they were getting into, moving in her mind first through her friends who tolerated her drinking, some barely, and then those who applauded it and drank with her. She had an equal number of both and needed both in different ways, the former to protect her and apologize to the party hosts and restaurant patrons and wedding guests she appalled with her behavior and her mouth, the latter to goad her on as she took off her bikini top or hurled a pool cue like a javelin. But she didn't text anyone. Tonight, she would be a lone wolf. Sometimes that was best for everyone. And so, certainly not proud of herself, but not precisely disgusted either, she showered, slipped into a pair of tight, come-hither jeans and a white blouse that was perfect for the last Saturday night in July, and went out into the dark. She wore the shade of lipstick the airline preferred for her, a deep scarlet that would help the hearing-impaired read her lips in the event of an emergency. Was she too old to have kicked off her heels and danced barefoot on a floor sticky with spilled beer in a dark club in the East Village, courting a noise-induced hearing loss because the band's amps were set to Jet Engine? Probably. But she wasn't the only woman who was suddenly barefoot. She was merely the oldest. And she didn't care about her age or her feet, because she was doing this sober, and that left her unexpectedly pleased. This was the foolishness the heart craved. She'd found a bar with a band and a party. It was still the middle of summer, and the people were beautiful. She was nowhere near Dubai. The guy she was dancing with, an actor with Greg Allman hair, honey-colored and lush, had just finished doing 6 weeks of Shakespeare in Virginia. He said he was 35 and was here because one of the dudes on the stage that moment had been in a show with him that spring in Brooklyn. The musical had needed someone who could play the guitar as well as sing and act.
"You're sure I can't get you a beer?"
he shouted into her ear. His name was Buckley, which she had told him was the best name ever for a Shakespearean actor, and he had agreed, but he was from Westport, and that was the name he got. And it hadn't been a great name when he was doing a musical about the 1970s punk scene last year at the Public. And Buck, he had reminded her, was far worse. If you were a performer named Buck, you were either a cowboy or a porn star. "Positive," she reassured him. She jumped and spun and had both of her hands over her head, the bass from the stage thrumming inside her. And then Buckley's fingers were on the small of her waist, pulling her into him, and when she brought her hands down, she rested them on the back of his neck, and suddenly they were kissing, and it was electric. When they were at the bar catching their breath a few minutes later, she asked one of the bartenders, a young thing in a tight denim shirt and straight black hair that fell to her waist, to bring him a shot of tequila.
"Oh, man, I shouldn't,"
he said, laughing. His cheeks flushed, but he took the small glass. Of course you should, Cassie told him. It's well after midnight.
What does that have to do with anything?
Witching hour. He took one of the drapes of his hair and pushed it back behind his ear.
Seriously?
He had asked the question sincerely, as if he expected he was about to learn something. It was almost sweet. Still, she was surprised at his reluctance to go from tipsy to drunk. It was a shot of tequila. One shot. They weren't talking about heating a spoonful of crack. She expected more from an actor, even one who had grown up in Fairfield County, Connecticut. She was holding her shoes, and she put them down on the seat of the empty bar stool near them. Then, with one hand, she reached out and took a rope of that magnificent mane of his, not at all surprised at how soft it was. With the other, she took the small glass she'd ordered for him and swallowed the shot of tequila. The burn was deep and hot and seemed to ooze out from her chest like an oil spill. It was heavenly. So much for not drinking tonight.
And yet you passed on the beer,
he said, smiling. His grin was childlike, his eyes impish. I like tequila.
But not beer.
I'm a flight attendant, remember? The uniform is unforgiving.
Do airlines still worry about weight? Can they do that?
It's vague. Weight must be proportional to height. But you really can't do your job if you're fat. I'll be in the gym again tomorrow.
Because you fly?
Because I'm vain.
Tell me the craziest thing you've ever seen.
As a flight attendant?
Yes. You hear stories that are just insane.
She nodded. She honestly couldn't say whether flying made people weird, or whether people were inherently weird and a closed cabin just made it more apparent. You hear them, she said. We live them.
I know. Tell me some. Tell me one.
She closed her eyes and saw Alex Sokolov in the bed beside her. She saw once again the deep, wet furrow across his neck. She saw herself crouched against the drapes in the hotel room in Dubai, naked, his blood on her shoulder and in her hair. You should have a shot first, she said.
That bad?
I'll have another one with you. She slipped her shoes back on, trying not to focus on how filthy her feet had become, and took his hand and led him to the bar. She wasn't going to share with him the tale of the young hedge fund manager who had died in the bed beside her on the Arabian Peninsula. There wasn't enough tequila in the world to get her to tell him that nightmare. And so instead, as they dared each other to keep downing shots, a second, a third, a fourth, she told him of the passengers who had tried to open exit doors at 35,000 feet, and the couples who honestly believed they were being discreet when their hands were under the blankets while the rest of the cabin was asleep. She told him of the man who had tried to climb over the beverage cart. He got as far as one knee on the top and his foot on the bag of ice on the shelf because he wanted to get to the bathroom and couldn't or wouldn't wait. She shared with him her encounter with the rock star who purchased the entire first-class cabin for himself and his entourage. I wasn't allowed to speak to him. I had to whisper the drink and menu options into his bodyguard's ear. I wasn't even allowed to make eye contact with him. The flight was an overnight to Berlin, and he didn't sleep a wink. Even though the lights were dimmed and his party was sound asleep, his bodyguard too. He went into the lavatory and changed his clothes 3 times, each outfit more outrageous than the one before it. For about an hour and a half, he was in a gold sequin jumpsuit and platform heels, and his only audience was me. She told him the different locales on the plane where they tended to stow the tough cuffs, and the different occasions when she had needed them to restrain a passenger. And then she told him about Hugo Fournier. She wasn't sure he would know the name, but he would know the story. He probably presumed it was an urban legend. But it wasn't. She'd been there. She'd been on the flight. So, we're flying from Paris to JFK. It's a route I bid on a lot. I was younger then, and so I got it less often. This was 8 years ago. And when I got it, I usually had business class.
That's a bad thing?
No, it's just that sometimes it can be a difficult cabin. On some aircraft, in first, everyone has a flat bed and is out like a light pretty soon into the flight. In coach, there's really not a whole lot you ever have to do. But business has 32 seats, and there's almost the same cabin service as first. And they sleep less. So some flight attendants feel it's a little less desirable, which means that whoever's working in it might have less seniority.
Okay.
So this particular flight is packed, not a single empty seat. Maybe an hour west of Ireland when we're on dessert in business, this guy who has been flying with the airline forever pushes past me to get to the chief purser who was working in first. He is oozing adrenaline, and the idea crosses my mind that there is some mechanical disaster. I literally think an engine is on fire. No more than 30 seconds later, I hear the chief purser on the intercom asking if there is a doctor or nurse on board. She sounds pretty cool, but I hear just a quiver of desperation. Of course, I'm also relieved that we're not about to ditch in the ocean.
Of course.
There is a doctor. There are, in fact, two. One in coach and one in business. And they both rush to seat 24E, where Hugo Fournier, old and diabetic and obese, has just had a massive heart attack. The doctors, one female and one male, and the flight attendants, lay him out on the floor in front of the galley and emergency exit row, because that's where they can find the most room. They get out the defib and work on the guy, and they work him hard. The doctors try everything, and they don't call it for at least 40 minutes. Everyone in the cabin knows what's going on. His wife is freaking out. She is shrieking and pleading and crying. Can you blame her? It's not a dignified performance, but it's a real one.
God.
Yep. But now we, you know, the crew, have to do something with the body. We can't put him back where he was. He's in the middle of economy, and while those are the cheap seats, people still don't expect to sit next to a corpse. Plus, he's covered in vomit. And while we could clean that off his shirt and pants, we couldn't clean off the stench. And the body did what bodies do when they die. Poor Hugo Fournier had crapped his pants. Buckley put his hands on his face and shook his head.
I do know this story.
Of course you do.
You put him in the bathroom for the rest of the flight.
Well, I didn't, but yes, the crew did. I actually lobbied that we try and get one of the people in first to give up their flatbed, but our chief purser wouldn't have it. I suggested we put him in 1A or 1L, so almost no one would see him or smell him, but she wouldn't even ask. So, yes, one of the doctors and two of the male flight attendants wedged him into the starboard mid-cabin lavatory. The doctor, a pretty judgmental guy in hindsight, said it was like getting a size 10 foot into a size 8 shoe.
And you didn't turn around?
The plane? No, we were already over the mid-Atlantic. We didn't want to inconvenience 258 people. And so instead, we inconvenienced one. She just happened to be a widow. A loud widow.
Amazing.
Or appalling.
You got that Scheherazade thing down.
He said. Most of us are pretty good storytellers, she agreed. We are the kings and queens of the degrading.
Where did you say you just flew in from? I can't remember.
I didn't say.
Okay, then. Where?
Such a simple question. It demanded but a one-word answer. Two syllables. And yet she couldn't bring herself to say it right now. It would be like waking in the middle of the night in a dark room and switching on Klieg lights. Berlin, she lied. She was prepared to embellish the trip if she had to, if it came to that. But it didn't.
And you still like the job?
He asked. She rolled back her head, lolling in the heaviness that came with a fourth shot. Perhaps because she'd just lied, she felt an acute need to admit something. To give him something real. The need to confess was irresistible. When you start as young as I did, right out of college, it's usually because you're running from something. You just have to get out to get away. it wasn't a career change for me. It wasn't even a choice in some ways. It was just a road somewhere.
An escape?
You could say that.
From?
They were sitting down now, and it was 1:45. They were on stools, side by side at the bar, but they were facing each other. She reached over and hooked her fingers just inside the front pockets of his jeans, locking him gamically to her. His eyes had the fuzzy, drunk stare she liked. She wouldn't have been surprised if hers were a little loopy, too. There's a town at the edge of the Cumberland Mountains in Kentucky called Grover's Mill. Pretty quaint, right?
Whereabouts?
She shook her head and purred. Shh. Her voice the wind in the night. Then, I'm Scheherazade. He nodded. It's small and quiet, she continued. Not a lot happens there. Imagine a girl in 6th grade with strawberry blonde hair. It's up in a bun because she fancies herself a dancer, and she does nothing in moderation. Never has and, alas, never will.
This is you.
So it would seem. And today is her birthday. And while Grover's Mill doesn't have much, it has a creamery that makes ice cream. Really good ice cream. At least this 11-year-old thinks so. And so her mom has a big idea for her birthday, because they really can't afford a whole lot in the way of presents. And her birthday has fallen smack in the middle of the week. And so there sure as hell isn't going to be a party. Of course, there probably wouldn't have been a party even if her birthday had fallen on a Friday or a Saturday, because you just didn't dare bring kids over to the house on the weekend, because that was usually when Dad was most likely to get seriously and impressively hammered. Anyway, Mom goes to the creamery and buys a tub of her daughter's favorite flavor.
Rum raisin?
Cute, but no. Chocolate chip cookie dough. And she buys her daughter a 2-gallon tub. Do you know how many pints that is? 16. She stops by the creamery on her way home from work. She's a receptionist at this creepy electrical wire factory in this otherwise forgotten ghost town next door to Grover's Mill, and buys this restaurant-sized 2-gallon tub of ice cream. Just so you know, the girl's birthday is in September, and it was one freaking hot September that year. You can look it up.
I trust you.
She dug her fingers a little deeper into his pants pockets, kneading the flesh of his thighs ever so slightly. So Mom has all this ice cream in a bag, along with some groceries, in the trunk of her car. She's going to get home just about the same time as her husband. Her 11-year-old kid is already home, a kind of classic latchkey little despot. She has a kid sister who's 8, but that day the kid sister was at her weekly brownie meeting. Their father was picking her up on his way home from the high school where he was a PE coach and driver's ed teacher. As Mom is nearing the street where her family lives, she sees a police car. It's maybe 1/4 mile from her house. It's parked, but its lights are on. And then she sees her daughter.
You.
Even in that one syllable, she could hear the slight catch in his throat as she teased him through the thin strip of fabric that comprised the inside of his pants pocket. No, silly. That 11-year-old is home, remember? She sees the 8-year-old. The child is still wearing her brownie sash with all of these very colorful badges. And then she sees her husband's crappy Dodge Colt. Robin's egg blue. A hatchback. And it's wrapped around a telephone pole. She stops, absolutely terrified, her heart sinking. But thankfully no one's injured. Her little girl is stunned, scared, but mostly fine. A couple of bruises on her arm. And her husband? He's in the back seat of the police cruiser. Handcuffed. Drunk. So she follows the police car to the police station and uses all the money in their pathetic little savings account at their pathetic little bank to bail him out. This takes a while.
Of course it does.
And by the time she gets home with her drunk of a husband and their adorable brownie of a daughter, by the time they pull into the driveway and pop the trunk, all that ice cream for the older girl's birthday is gone. He reached down and lifted her fingers from his pockets and held them tenderly in his hands.
Someone stole the ice cream? At the police station?
Nope. It melted. It melted through the cardboard tub and then through the paper bag. Some of it seeped into the fabric of the trunk, and some of it just sloshed around the back of the car like the fluid inside a snow globe.
God, that's so sad.
She raised an eyebrow. Sharing with him the moment hadn't made her sad at all. It actually had made her rather happy. It was something to get off her chest. It was a memory from a place she'd never, ever see again. She looked at the other bartender, a young guy with a string of silver piercings the length of his ear on the other side of Buckley. She gazed at the neon signs for beer and the white lights over the ice trays behind the thick mahogany counter, and she found herself smiling. Nah, she said to him. He was gently rubbing the part of her hand between her thumb and her index finger. Sad is when the Easter Bunny comes on a Monday. That was way worse.
How is that possible?
She hesitated. Just how much could she wallow in this before it really would ruin their buzz? But then she decided that she didn't care and plowed ahead. The Easter Bunny arriving the day after Easter? 1 year my grandfather had a stroke and my mom had to race to the hospital in Louisville. She was gone the Friday and Saturday before Easter, then Easter Sunday and Monday. And my dad just didn't cope. The good news? With all the chocolate and jelly beans on sale the next day, you know, half and two-thirds off, he bought my sister and me a hell of a lot more candy than the Easter Bunny was ever going to bring. Buckley lifted her hands and kissed her fingertips. So, she said, are we going to my place or yours? In the morning, she awoke and saw a strip of the Empire State Building through the vertical blinds of her bedroom window. She sensed Buckley beside her in bed, and for a moment she held her breath to listen. She recalled initiating their retreat to his place or hers at the bar, viewing it as a dare of sorts. Regardless of where they wound up, she wanted to see if she had become some sort of alcoholic assassin as 40 neared. And suddenly she was killing the men with whom she slept. It had been a private challenge of sorts, a deliberate provocation of the soul. He exhaled, and she felt him move, and a little wave of relief left her momentarily giddy. He reached his arm across her hips and belly and pulled her against him.
"Good morning," he murmured. "But don't roll over. I have a feeling I have serious morning breath. Serious hangover breath."
"I probably do, too," she said, and rose to get them both Advil. She knew he was watching her.
"You're beautiful naked," he said.
"I'm glad you think so." In the bathroom mirror, she looked at the red lines in her eyes and the bags below them. She didn't feel beautiful. But at least this hangover was a piker compared to the one that had welcomed the morning after in Dubai. She wondered if Buckley would want to go to brunch. She rather hoped not. She liked him, but she really wasn't hungry. The fact was, she was almost never all that hungry. After years of boozing it up, it was as if her body craved its calories from alcohol. There was a reason she was likely to have canned soup and stale crackers for dinner. She considered bringing him two or three of the red pills, but then wondered if he was similar to her and downed them like peanuts, or the sort who followed the instructions on the label and would begin with just one. So she brought the whole bottle along with a glass of water. She opened the blinds and squinted at the way the cone of the New York Life Building shimmered in the sun, and then crawled back under the sheets. She watched a plane as it crossed the skyline outside her window, flying north before banking east to LaGuardia.
"Hungry?"
he asked. "No."
"You sound sad."
One syllable gave all that away? "Nah, just not hungry." She heard him put the glass and the bottle down on the nightstand on his side of the bed.
"When you're in Germany, do you ever begin the day with eggs and mustard sauce?"
"No, never. And what in the name of God made you think of Germany just now?"
You were in Berlin yesterday.
Oh, right.
Doesn't sound like you're a fan of eggs.
Not with mustard.
They're hard-boiled and delicious,
he insisted. Then,
I like your apartment.
She wished she could will into existence the woman she had been last night, the one who danced barefoot and made this very gentle actor happy, the one who wasn't repulsed by the idea of brunch and his hints about eggs and food. But that person didn't exist in the morning. Most of the time, that person didn't exist sober. It was almost fascinating how rapidly her resolve not to drink could dissipate. It was like the thin coat of ice on a Kentucky pond in late January. There one day, and just gone the next. And yet she knew in her heart that she wouldn't drink today. That wasn't how it worked for her. She'd send Buckley on his way, go to the animal shelter and nurture the depressed cats. The new arrivals that had just been deserted by their owners for one reason or another, and were shocked to be living in a cage in a loud, strange world. And then finish the day at the gym. Tonight, she would cocoon, her body clock happily adjusted once again to Eastern Daylight Time. She would read and she would watch TV. She would see no one tonight. She would be fine. She had until Tuesday here. Then, with a crew full of strangers, not even Megan and Shane would be on the plane, she would fly to Italy. The August routes she had bid on were Rome and Istanbul. Both were direct flights from JFK. No Dubai. "Can I tell you something?" she asked. She needed to scare him away to get on with her day and, more importantly, with her life.
"Sure, but this sounds ominous. Will it be as sad as all that melted ice cream?"
"No. Maybe. I'm not sure. I don't know yet what I'm going to tell you."
"Wow. It sounded like you had something in mind. Usually when a person begins, 'Can I tell you something?' they're thinking of some pretty specific revelation or pretty specific bit of news."
She was still on her side. She brought her knees closer to her stomach and rested her hands together under the pillow as if she were praying. "I was just thinking about my day and what I'm going to do this afternoon. The main thing is I'm going to the animal shelter. I love the shelter. I go when I'm home because my mother wouldn't let me have pets as a girl, and now I've managed to pick a career where I traveled too much to have one, at least in good conscience." A moment ago, he had sat up to swallow the Advil and drink the water. She imagined if she rolled over, she would see he was watching her. Perhaps he was propped up on his elbow, looking down at her. "I mean, we did have a pet when I was little. Very little. We had a dog. My parents had gotten him before I was born. Years before I was born. But when I was 5, my father ran him over. The dog was old and asleep in the grass beside the driveway, and my dad was so drunk when he came home that afternoon he missed the pavement and, quite literally, ran him over. Didn't just hit him. Crushed him. And so we never had pets after that. My mom was afraid something would happen to them." She recalled her parents' fights about pets, about cats and dogs. She and her sister would cry, and her father would lobby with slurred words on their behalf, and he would fail. Did her father feel demeaned, emasculated? She assumed so now. Her mother once said if her father stopped drinking, they could consider a cat or a dog, but that was never going to happen, even after his DUI or after the high school fired him as the driver's ed teacher. Much to everyone's astonishment, he was still allowed to teach P.E. As a girl, she had felt only the unfairness of her mother's edict. It was as if she and her sister were being punished for their father's misbehavior.
"I think it's really sweet that you go to the shelter on your day off," said Buckley.
"I guess I do it for me."
"And for them."
"I should get dressed," she told him.
"Is that a hint?"
"Yes."
"Got it. You know, if you want me to leave, there are easier ways than dredging up a horrible memory about a dead dog. I'm pretty chill, trust me."
She didn't roll over. "Oh, I never seem to do things the easy way."
"No?"
"No." Then, And I'm sure you have someplace you need to be too, right? She felt him swinging his feet over the bed. She expected him to stand up, but he didn't. He sat there a long moment and then said softly,
Just so you know, I don't usually do this. I don't sleep with strangers when I'm on tour or in a theater out of state, and I don't when I'm home here in the city.
She sighed. I do.
Okay, of all the things you've told me in the last 12 or whatever hours, that's got to be the saddest.
And with that, he finally stood. He picked up his clothes from the floor by her closet, his body angular and taut. She heard him go into the bathroom to throw some water on his face before going home, but she kept her hands under her pillow, her knees bent, and tried to lie there as quiet and fixed as a corpse. And in the night, she wept. It was, she tried to convince herself, because of the cats. They always got to her. The 13-year-old calicos that had lived together their whole lives, discarded because their owner had a new boyfriend and he insisted he was allergic to them. The rough and ruddy orange Tom dropped off because the family was moving. He probably weighed 20 pounds, all muscle, and now was unwilling to lift his head and emerge from his cage. There were rail-thin black cats from a crazy hoarder, one with her ear half gone from a fight, all of them awash in fleas and ticks when they arrived. She was too depressed for the gym. Instead, she went to a bookstore and browsed the shelves of paperback fiction, pausing in the aisles that held Chekhov and Pushkin and Tolstoy. She considered a Turgenev collection because Alex had mentioned him, and she was unfamiliar with his work. But the only title the store had was Fathers and Sons, and that relationship held little allure for her that afternoon. Eventually, she bought a small book by Tolstoy. Small for Tolstoy, but still nearly 400 pages. Because the first story in it was called Happy Ever After. She suspected the title was likely ironic, but she could hope. At home, however, she discovered the book was quite possibly the worst choice she could have made, which perhaps shouldn't have surprised her, given her predilection for bad choices. At least the first story started out badly, given her own personal history. On the very first page, the narrator, a 17-year-old woman named Masha, shares that she is mourning the death of her mother. Cassie had been a teenager, too, when her mother had died. Masha also had a younger sister. Cassie didn't get beyond the fourth page before putting the book down and taking a lint brush to her clothes, removing the evidence of her day at the shelter. But she didn't change. Nor that night did she drink. Not a drop. And so she was still dressed and sober and sad when she got the call from a fellow who introduced himself as Derek Mays. She couldn't put a face to the name, and she presumed it was a lover or Tinder score who didn't realize, or didn't understand, that she didn't want to see him again and confront what they'd done, but hadn't wanted to hurt his feelings.
"I'm with the union," he explained, his tone clipped, a trace of a New York accent.
He said that two other members of the cabin crew on the flight to Dubai had reached out to him, and he had already met with one of them, Megan Briscoe. He, in turn, had called the FBI, and it was clear that he needed to see her, too, and get up to speed fast on whatever she knew about the passenger in 2C.
"I want to know what really went on between you two on the flight, and what really happened in Dubai," he said.
And with that, there was a sudden ringing in her ears. Her legs grew wobbly, and she wondered if this, not waking up beside the cold, still body of Alex Sokolov, was the demarcation between before and after. This, she thought with a terrible certainty, might really be the moment she would look back upon as the point where it all began to unravel. Part 2. Burn the Carbons.
Federal Bureau of Investigation. FD 302, redacted. Megan Briscoe, flight attendant. Date, July 28, 2018. Megan Briscoe, date of birth, social security number, telephone number, was interviewed by properly identified special agents Ann McConnell and Bruce Zimmerewski at JFK International Airport immediately upon her flight's arrival in the U.S. McConnell conducted the interview. Zimmerewski took these notes. After being advised of the nature of the interview, Briscoe provided the following information. Briscoe said that she has been with the airline for 24 years. Prior to that, she had worked in guest services for Dover Star Hotels in Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Maryland, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Briscoe said that she had very little contact with Alexander Sokolov on Flight 4094. He was being cared for by flight attendant Cassandra Bowden. She thought Bowden and Sokolov had flirted, but she said Bowden was always a bit of a flirt. She had seen Bowden flirt with other passengers on other flights. Briscoe explained that she and Bowden are friends and sometimes work their schedules so they share the same routes and can fly together. Though she lives now in Virginia, her base remains JFK. She did not know what Bowden and Sokolov may have discussed. When asked whether she and Bowden saw each other in Dubai, she said no, they did not. She said there were 13 crew members on the flight and they separated into different groups, which was normal. She herself went out to dinner at a Japanese restaurant with Jada Morris, Shane Hebert, and Victoria Morgan. She did not explain why she did not have dinner with her friend, Cassandra Bowden.
Chapter 7. Elena's mother always had corgis. These days she had three, one of which was a descendant of the two dogs she'd had when she divorced Elena's father. She trained the animals to come with an antique silver summoner patterned after the onion-shaped domes that adorned St. Basil's in Moscow or the Church of Our Savior on Spilled Blood in St. Petersburg. It predated the First World War and thus the Revolution. According to the antique dealer, it may have belonged once to the Romanovs. Elena presumed he was lying, and her mother probably did too. But that never stopped her mother from telling people that the summoner had resided once at the Winter Palace. The nails on the dog's paws would click along the hardwood floors when they scampered to her across her palatial apartment near the Kremlin. If her mother was seated, they would stand up on their hind legs and put their front legs onto her lap, exactly the way she had taught them. Her own lady with lapdog moment, but played to oligarchic excess. The animals traveled with her on the plane she bought after the divorce. She had special in-seat safety harnesses created for them for the flights. The straps were lined with the same mink that adorned the safety belts on the Art Deco-inspired Manhattan airship seats she had designed for the humans. Her mother never remarried. Neither did her father. Sometimes Elena would see her mother on the gossip or society pages in an evening gown with waterfalls of jewelry dangling from her ears and around her neck, a Moscow robber baron on her arm. Sometimes she would see a photo of her on the social networks that someone had taken at the Bolshoi or the Botanical Garden. She knew that one of her father's friends had suggested poisoning the dogs after the divorce. Now that gentleman assisted the Syrian government in Damascus. He'd helped Assad squirrel away sarin in 2013 when the international monitors were destroying the rest of the stockpile. But her father had refused to kill the animals. Unlike some of his friends, now she guessed some of hers, her father didn't approve of incidental killing or the slaughter of non-combatants. Elena had inherited that trait from him, she supposed. Certainly that was one reason why the flight attendant was still alive. In some ways, her mother had a far more entrenched killer instinct than her father. Exhibit A, the divorce settlement. She was ruthless. And her mother had realized early on that her daughter was a daddy's girl, though maybe that was inevitable given the woman's disinterest in child-rearing. Or maybe that had been the plan all along. Her mother had visited her just the one time when she was a teenager in Switzerland, and she'd never once come to Boston when Elena went there for college. The truth was, Elena hadn't seen her mother in years and really didn't miss her. She doubted her mother missed her either. She looked down once more at the Moscow newspaper she had opened a few minutes ago. More violence in Donetsk. The continued rebound of the ruble. An American drone strike in Yemen. She knew it was this last story that was most likely to catch Victor's interest. America and China remained the only countries in the world that had successfully weaponized drones, and America's were far beyond China's. It was among the reasons why the Russians had such pathological drone envy, and why Russian military intelligence was obsessed with the American program. It was why Victor was spending so much time with the Emirates drone manufacturer. ISIS used toy drones as IEDs. Imagine a stealth drone or even a jet drone with a chemical payload. She finished her tea and recalled her father's samovar. It was rare, a tombak bronze, and once it had belonged to his great-grandmother. Somehow the family had retained it through both revolution and world war. Through Stalin and Malenkov and Khrushchev. It resided now with her mother, of course. Somehow the woman had gotten even that, the samovar that neither the Bolsheviks nor the Nazis had been able to wrest from the Orlovs.
Chapter 8. Cassie met the union official for breakfast at a diner on the corner of 26th and 3rd. Derek Mays had chubby salt-and-pepper caterpillars above his eyes, the brows shading tortoise-shell eyeglasses, and a face just starting to grow jowly. He was mostly bald, and his seersucker blazer had blotches of black city dust, but the blue matched his eyes. His wedding band was thick, like his fingers. She pegged him for his late 60s.
"I went through your records," he was saying.
He was eating scrambled eggs and home fries and bacon. She was nursing a bowl of oatmeal, both because she wasn't especially hungry and because her anxiety had made her queasy.
"You were on the Hugo Fournier flight. Infamous."
"I guess."
"Man, some of you were in deep water on that one. Stowing a dead guy in the bathroom? That widow was pissed. And, oh my God, what a PR nightmare for the airline. For the union. Remember the Tonight Show? Conan? The New York Post? I remember the comics trotted out all the terms. Trolley dolly. Air mattress. Sky muffin. It's like it was 1967 and you were all stewardesses again. Like there were no male flight attendants."
"The female terms are all about sex. The male ones are degrading in a different way. A lot end with boy." He nodded.
"Juice boy. Cop boy.
Anyway, I really wasn't involved in the decision about what to do with the body."
"I know. We would have met then, if you had been. But we had that purses back, and everything turned out okay. And it was never a criminal thing."
"Like this?"
"Yeah, like this. At least I think like this. It's just so typical of the FBI. So typical. They don't call the union. They don't tell you to get a lawyer. It's infuriating. If they were going to meet the plane, they should have told us so we could make sure there was someone in the room with you."
"Are you going to meet with every employee who was on the plane?"
"Oh, yeah,"
he said, almost chuckling at the certainty as he spoke.
"Look, every person the guy met the last couple of days is of interest now. Someone in Dubai or someone in America is going to want to talk to every single bellhop and waitress and concierge and, yes, flight attendant he might have said boo to. Every single one. Of course, it's really only you and Megan and Jada I'm worried about. You're the three."
"Because?"
"Because you were the ones handling first class, and you were the ones who were in direct contact with Sokolov."
"And you said they both called you?"
"Damn right they did. You should have called me too," he said,
and she felt chastised. "You live in the city?" she asked. After she spoke, she wondered if she should have apologized to him for not reaching out to the union on Saturday. But she had been so relieved when the FBI's Frank Hammond hadn't even asked about her whereabouts in Dubai that it hadn't crossed her mind to contact them. She had been in something like shock at the way she thought she might have dodged a bullet. Mays nodded as he chewed.
Then, I live about 10 blocks south of here. My wife and I always figured we'd move out to Long Island when we had children, but we never did. So we just stayed. And we like the neighborhood. Lot of NYU kids. Makes us feel younger than we are.
I like that area, too. Especially in September when the freshmen arrive. They are just so young. He smiled.
And they get younger every year.
So, what did Megan say? Or Jada? It felt like she was feeling her way in the dark. So far, she and Derek had discussed her path to the airline. But the most revealing thing she had shared was that she had made it through the University of Kentucky on financial aid and a work-study job at the college switchboard. She'd manned the console, an antique as the 21st century loomed, from midnight to 8 a.m. two nights a week. Almost no one ever called. Mostly, she alerted campus security when students locked themselves out of their rooms or when women wanted a safe ride back to their dorms. Mostly, she wrote papers and worried about her kid sister and the foster home where Rosemary was parked until she finished high school. Cassie didn't drink then. She guessed this was irony, given the way that so many of her peers seemed to live on keg beer and boxed wine. He wiped his mouth with the paper napkin and then used it on his fingers.
They said they barely spoke to him. By and by. Jada thinks she may have brought him the basket of breads midway through the lunch service and asked if he wanted another roll. She may have offered him a newspaper and asked if he wanted English or French. But they both said, when I asked, that you spoke to him a lot.
Why did you ask?
Because I needed to know who was taking care of the guy and talking to him, if they weren't. And they both said it was you. Jada said he chatted you up pretty seriously.
For a second, she said nothing. She was grateful that Jada had told Maze that Alex had been chatting her up, the implication being that he had paid more attention to her than she had paid to him. The truth was somewhere closer to the middle. Still, she wondered, was this the moment when she should confess? Tell this union official that she needed a lawyer and the union's help? Tell him that there was a woman in this world named Miranda who may have had something to do with Alex's hedge fund and had seen her in Alex's hotel suite at the Royal Phoenician that night. But she let the moment pass, as she had every other opportunity she'd had to start over. Derek Mays wanted to help her, but she rather doubted there was any variant on attorney-client privilege between the two of them that could withstand a court of law. Whatever she told him could come back to haunt her. "I told the FBI everything I knew when we landed," she said firmly. "I know it wasn't very much, but he was just one more passenger on just one more flight."
"Yes and no."
She waited. It took control not to sit back in the seat and fold her arms across her chest. The waitress refilled their coffee, and Maze poured the last of the milk and the small, tinny creamer into his mug.
"What does that mean?" she asked.
"Yes, to you, he was just one more passenger on just one more flight," he said carefully, and for a moment she began to relax.
His construction suggested that no one really knew anything about her involvement with the man.
"But I don't think he was just a hedge fund guy. Yesterday was busier than I like for a Sunday in the summer. I think the FBI is going to want to speak to you again."
"Me or the cabin crew?" she asked. She heard the quiver in her voice. Her mouth had gone dry.
"Cabin crew."
"The FBI told you that?"
"They did."
"Why?"
"I don't know. They wouldn't tell me."
He leaned in conspiratorially.
"Look, you spent the most time with the guy on the plane. That's a fact."
"So?"
"He was part of your section in first class. You were the one serving him. Don't get me wrong, the other flight attendants aren't throwing you under the bus, but both Megan and Jada said you two were yakking it up every time you brought the guy a glass of wine or refilled his coffee cup. You spent a hell of a lot more time with 2C than you did with, I don't know, 4C.
"That's not true."
"You two weren't yakking it up?"
"No." He shrugged.
"Look, even if it were true, why would that be a problem?"
"I was polite to him."
"I'm serious, Cassie." Even if you were flirting with the guy, why would that be an issue?
Because it would be unprofessional.
He chuckled, but it was a mean laugh. Yeah, flight attendants never flirt with passengers, or pilots. Never.
He rolled his eyes.
You know how high the divorce rate is in your profession? I guess that's why flight attendants and pilots only wind up married to each other. You're away from home all the time, you're flirting all the time, you're in hotels all the time, and...
And what?
And no one gets you except people like you. No one gets the weirdness of the lifestyle. No one else could possibly understand.
She sighed. It's inevitable we wind up together. It's simply because we all work together. I'm sure ad people marry ad people and lawyers marry lawyers. All professions have office romances.
Yeah, but you don't all work together. You don't. That's the thing. You almost never have the same people on the same crew. I mean, you and Megan are bid buddies, and I guess she and Shane are bid buddies. But there were 10 flight attendants on that airplane to Dubai, and 7 of you had never seen each other before that JFK Dubai sequence and may never, ever see each other again. Or if you do, it will be years from now. And that's just the cabin crew. Add in the folks in the cockpit. When will you fly next with any of those pilots? A year from now? 2? 10? No, Cassie. Sorry. You don't work together.
Where is this going? I thought you wanted to help me.
I do. And that's why I need to be sure that this Sokolov character didn't tell you something meaningful, or you didn't learn something about him that you should be sharing with a lawyer, or just maybe the FBI.
Nope.
Because by now the FBI knows you are flirting with him, and by now they know that you were not having dinner that night in Dubai with any member of the crew, including your friend Megan. If I know that from my limited conversations, then they do from their interviews.
Why does that matter?
Maybe it doesn't. But just in case. Anything you want to tell me about that night in Dubai?
I went to bed.
In the airline's hotel?
Yes.
Did you go out to eat?
No, she answered, wondering the moment the syllable had escaped her lips whether she had spoken too quickly. There surely were witnesses at the restaurant, but she also knew instantly that his next question would be about room service, and it was.
So you had something sent up to your room?
No.
You didn't eat?
I wasn't feeling great. I ate some peanuts from the minibar. I fell asleep. She couldn't imagine they could actually check such a thing. How accurate, really, was hotel monitoring of the minibar?
So, you didn't go out?
Did someone say I did?
Not to me.
Okay, then.
But according to 2 airline employees in the cabin with you, you were flirting with Alex Sokolov. And then, it seems, you weren't hanging out with anyone from the flight crew that night. No one. You just disappeared.
Into my hotel room, she snapped, cutting him off. She saw over Maze's shoulder that she had spoken so harshly that the 2 older men having breakfast together at the next table turned, their heads swiveling like owls. Maze opened his hands, palms up, and sat back.
Got it, he said. Got it. But for all we know, the FBI is going to talk to the passengers who are seated near Sokolov on the flight, and it's possible that one or more of them is going to say you and the guy were friendly. I don't know yet if Sokolov was from some wealthy or well-connected family, or whether he just wasn't what he said he was. I don't know what he was really doing in Dubai. Maybe it really was just a meeting with investors. But this story has legs, so I want to be sure you do 3 things, okay?
Fine. Tell me. She hoped that her lies and her fear would be misconstrued for aggravation.
I want you to get a lawyer.
I can't afford a lawyer, she said, even though she recalled vividly her vow in the hotel suite in Dubai that she would find one if somehow she made it back to America. I can barely afford my apartment. You know what I make. I'm broke. We're all broke. We all need more money than we have.
So does everyone. So relax. I can help you find a lawyer you can afford. Not a big deal. It's what we do.
I'm not saying yes, because I don't see why I need one. But what else?
Two, I want you to keep me informed with exactly what's going on.